How's everyone doing? Good? Moderate enthusiasm. Let me try that again. How is everyone doing? Okay, very good. Welcome to your first university lecture at Cornell. I hope you're enjoying your orientation experience so far, and I hope that you're getting settled into your dorms and getting to know your classmates. I did a little bit of background research on your class, the class of 2015, and I must say I'm quite impressed. You are incredibly, and I must say wonderfully, diverse, coming from a variety of different nationalities, different backgrounds, and different perspectives. You're the cream of the crop. You've been selected among thousands of applicants. And one of the things that really impressed me was that many of you are very active in service learning or service to your community and volunteerism, which I think is really a great thing. So welcome to Cornell. I am going to be talking a little bit about pandemics today as part of the book project. I'm a professor in the Department of Entomology in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, which is just one of the many colleges across campus. I conduct research on mosquito biology and mosquito-transmitted infections that impact human health. So I work on malaria and dengue, yellow fever, and so on. And I'm going to be talking to you today about something that is very near and dear to my heart. I've been fascinated by disease outbreaks for quite some time. And in fact, I teach a course here at Cornell, which is being offered this fall, called Plagues and People. This is a university course, and it's open to freshmen. So if any of you decide you want to learn more after the lecture today, you might want to check out this course. So I'm talking about influenza or flu, and I'm talking about the Spanish flu in the context of Doctorow's book, Homer and Langley. Why is that? Why am I talking about flu? There's so much in the book. Why am I talking about flu? Anyone? Yeah?
Their parents died for the flu.
That's right. Homer and Langley's parents died. Very good. You just got your first question right in your university lecture. And that's very true. Unfortunately, Homer and Langley's parents died during the 1918 flu outbreak in New York. Remember, their father died. Remember, Homer was home all by himself because Langley was off at war. The father died, and the mother died very soon after the father. Okay, so this was a very deadly disease outbreak. It had a significant impact on humans, culture, society, and health at the time. 50 to 100 million people died, and there was a 10 to 20% fatality rate, which is actually quite high for influenza. And about 500 million people, or think of it as one-third of the world's population at that time, were infected with the virus. In New York City, they were impacted very much by the flu. Initially, they weren't that concerned, and there was a lot of criticism of the mayor of New York and public health officials because they didn't act as quickly as they probably could have.
They started to impose some rules. Everyone had to wear a mask. You can see a variety of pictures here. People trying to go about their daily business wearing masks. They ended up closing down public functions, so theaters, like the one you're in now, were closed down because they didn't want to bring infected people in close proximity to healthy individuals. So the virus ended up sweeping across the country. These are some pictures from Seattle, policemen trying to go about their daily business. On the right is a streetcar conductor. They wouldn't allow anyone on public transport unless they wore a mask. Now, they didn't really know what flu was, right? The germ theory had been around for a while, But they didn't know exactly what flu was, but they suspected that it was something that was transmitted via inhalation of droplets when a person sneezed or coughed. And so, rightly so, they made people wear these masks. And flu really was everywhere. Everyone was talking about it. This is an example of a nursery rhyme that kids on the street started singing back in that time about influenza. So it really had an impact on culture. So what was the Spanish flu? Okay, so I'm going to give you your first multiple choice question. What was the Spanish flu? A, a bacteria. B, a germ. C, a quark. Or D, a virus. Okay? Show of hands for A. Show of hands for A. B. C. Okay? You quark fans in the audience. Or D. Okay, very good. Very good. It was a virus. The Spanish flu was an influenza virus, an H1N1 virus. Now, this should sound familiar because just 2 years ago, we had another outbreak of H1N1 influenza, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So you don't have to remember this. If you're a biology geek, you might want to remember this, or you already know this. But basically, the H1N1 comes from proteins that are on the outside of the virus. Neuraminidase and hemagglutinin. And the type of those proteins give the virus its nomenclature. And so this is a virus. A virus is a little packet of genetic material that invades host cells and utilizes the machinery in the host cell for its own benefit. A very, very simple organism that's potentially very deadly. All right, next question, your second multiple choice question. Where did the Spanish flu come from? A, Spain. B, Siberia. Or C, Kansas. All right, think carefully. How many hands for A, Spain? It's got to be called the Spanish flu for some reason, right? Sounds like a trick question, doesn't it? B, Siberia. Okay. Or C, Kansas. Okay, Kansas wins slightly, but you know, the jury's out. You all have different opinions about where it came from. In reality, but even though it was first reported in Kansas, it probably was. And so in reality, even though some of the first and most well-documented reports of the 1918 flu were from Fort Riley, Kansas, it probably didn't originate there. And today, scientists still don't know where the 1918 flu originated. What they do know is that there were three major sweeps that started and swept across the globe at the same time, one originating in Africa somewhere, one in Europe somewhere, and one potentially in the U.S. or brought to the U.S. from Europe. So it was in Fort Riley in the spring of 1918 that soldiers started getting ill. And this was alarming because these were very healthy young men that were coming down with flu. And so the first cases were reported there. But it was a fairly mild flu in the spring. But something happened between the spring and the fall of 1918. The virus changed. The genetic makeup changed. It became much more deadly. And it's that second wave that came through. It's that second wave that hit New York City and killed Homer Langley's parents. It probably was a very specialized situation where the troop movements, the fact that it was wartime and soldiers were in close confinement led to the rise of this more deadly strain of flu. Also the fact that the very severely ill were transported on public transport, on trains, to crowded hospitals where they could disseminate the virus to unsuspecting people. So the 1918 flu is a very, very serious infection. infection. It was initially misdiagnosed, but as more and more people became ill, the symptoms became apparent. Not all flus cause hemorrhaging or bleeding, but this particular one did. And so mortality occurred from bleeding or from secondary bacterial infections and pneumonia. And it happened very quickly. Some people were alive for only 2 days after they became infected. It happened very quickly. Today, we now know that it was a result of an immune response, an overactive immune response to the virus. And this is why the healthiest of the healthy were the ones who succumbed to the 1918 flu. So it had a significant impact on the economy, on commerce, on the psyche of individuals during that time period. Community shut down, shops were closed, even the healthcare workers were dead. There was no one to take care of the people who were sick and dying. Mass graves were dug. Now, Homer Langley's parents were lucky. They succumbed fairly early in that autumn, and they were buried in the cemetery. But as the pandemic went on, and fewer resources and people were available, they began to build to dig mass graves for the victims. So the 1918 flu had a significant impact, and a lot of controversy has arisen recently because that wasn't the end of the 1918 flu. Scientists have actually in 2005, they reported that they reconstructed the virus using reverse genetics. So they took tissue that had the virus in it from a woman who succumbed to the flu in Alaska and was buried in the permafrost. Very good way of preserving the viral material. So they recreated in the lab, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta has the virus now in their laboratory. Okay, so this is just one of many ethical questions that come up within the context of epidemics. And I want you to take a few minutes to think about the ethics of this question, okay? So I want you to turn to your neighbor and discuss with them how you feel about this question. Is it ethical to recreate deadly pathogens from the past? Okay? So turn to your neighbor, I'm going to give you a couple minutes. Okay, so the answer was that this is unethical because potentially the virus could be released from the lab accidentally. We've seen this actually with anthrax, right? With the anthrax killings of 2001, it was a laboratory derived strain in the U.S. Okay, so that's a concern, and that's a reason for feeling it should be unethical. And he also said that it died out naturally. If it died out naturally, it should stay that way. So maybe what you're implying is that by recreating it, you might tweak it a little bit genetically, so it might be a little different. Any other reasons why this might be unethical? Pardon me? unethical for research use, or you think you're for it? Okay, so I think what you're saying is that this is actually should be done because there's a benefit as far as research, right? So there's you can learn a lot more about why this was so deadly and how to prevent this from happening in the future to recreate the virus. And that's actually the rationale that the scientists use. And they, in the end, were able to determine that cytokine effect that I was talking about by infecting the animals with the recreated virus and examining their response. Okay, so we've been talking about pandemic flu, but you all are probably very familiar with seasonal flu. I'm sure every one of you has had seasonal flu at one point in time. And a lot of people don't realize that this is deadly as well. About 40,000 people die each year from seasonal influenza. Usually it's people who have a compromised immune system or older, elderly, or young individuals. In fact, about 90% of the deaths are among the elderly. But it's a significant infection, causing about $80 billion in healthcare costs, just here in this country alone. So how is the flu transmitted? Well, you know, they were wise when they enacted the law that everyone had to wear masks. That's why we're always covering mouth and nose. Victims can actually inhale aerosols. Also, there can be hand-mouth transmission. That's why hand washing strategies are so important for flu. You will see this winter on campus. You'll see hand sanitizing stations all over campus, and make sure you use them. I don't mean to scare you, but just to get you a little more aware. There are vaccines that are created for the flu, and here at Cornell, they offer vaccines to students. They're a little bit of a gamble because they're made a year before the flu season, and the scientists get them guess what flu strains are being circulated, and then they develop the vaccine based on the top flu. So we have seasonal flu that causes infection in Halloween, and then we have this major influenza pandemics. I've listed them here, starting with the Spanish flu, which was featured in the book, to the swine flu. How many people remember the swine flu outbreak? Okay? Nearly everyone should probably. Many of you are probably impacted by the swine flu outbreak. Maybe your school was shut down. Maybe you had family members who were ill. We certainly were impacted, sadly, here on campus. This is us from now. So the first cases of swine flu appeared or were reported from Mexico in March 2009. Notice that this, just like the 1918 flu, was an H1N1 flu virus. And it's thought that it originated in Mexico somewhere. And nearly a month later, it was a full-blown pandemic. The World Health Organization that decides when a pandemic is truly a pandemic declared it one, phase 6, on June 11, 2009. So where did this 2009 swine flu virus come from? Well, it was a virus that had little bits of genetic material from a variety of different viruses. It's what we call a quadruple reassortment virus. So it had a little bit of genetic material from the bird flu, a little bit from two different swine flu viruses, and then a little bit from the human flu virus. And somewhere along the way, the virus was mixed together with these other viruses to create this one super virus. And there was a lot of humans, right? Probably shouldn't hiss or lick pig sounds, but there was no reason, really, to stay away from humans. For example, the pork industry and even the chicken industry were severely impacted. There were a lot of fears. The media, which is one of the things we talked about in my class, the role of the media in reporting epidemics, and fear, played a significant role. We had Sanjay Gupta down in Mexico investigating the outbreak. We had numbers out of context that we had on the television. Every death is a loss, and a lot of people died. But there are 12,000 people who died from swine flu. That's less than half that die annually from the regular seasonal flu. And there are lots of dramatic actions, closing of schools. There were, in some cases, people felt overreactions. And a lot of fighting. Okay, and the last influenza outbreak I wanted to talk about was bird flu, which is still going on. And this originated in Asia, and it's primarily been circulating in Asia over the years. 2 years ago, there were major human cases of bird flu, not nearly the numbers that we have with the swine flu outbreak, but very high. In nearly all cases, individuals got the flu directly from these animals, from humble animals directly. Okay, so I just wanted to talk about a few other major pandemics that have occurred over time, and a few recent ones to keep an eye on. And then I'm going to finish up by talking about some of the plagues of the future, things that we should do in the future. So the Black Death, many of you have probably heard about this. What type of organism is this that causes Black Death? You don't know? Bacterium. Very good. See, I knew you guys were really smart. Okay. It's a bacterium, and there have been 3 major pandemics in history, and the middle pandemic is called the Black Death. This had a tremendous impact on human culture and human expression, and even on survival. Some people estimate that up to 2/3 of the population of Europe died. And it brought about in art this dance macabre movement where artists depicted skeletons in people's lives. It's a very somber period coming out of the Black Death. Some people feel it brought the end to feudalism. Many impacts on culture. Another pandemic is typhus. And we have a lot of typhus transmission today. It tends to be among people who are displaced, homeless, people from war-torn regions. It had a major impact on both world wars and even wars before Langley's World War I. For example, Napoleon's Grand Army probably was defeated as they marched on Moscow by typhus, not by the opposing army. And there are 2 plagues that I want to mention just briefly that we're experiencing today. One is sensory drug resistant tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is a major infection. It's fairly hard to treat. There are no new drugs that have been developed in the past 40 years for TB. And now there are some highly drug resistant strains of TB circulating. This individual, by the name of Spector, Andrew Spector, knowingly got on an airplane after his wedding and to fly to his honeymoon with his wife. And he knowingly had this extensively drug resistant TB. This brought up a lot of new ethical and legal issues that hadn't been faced before about people knowing the potentially infected individuals. Now, there were about 600 people that knew risk factor when the 2 plagues occurred. Fortunately, none of them ever became infected with this strain of TB. But it brought up some really serious issues that we will have to face. We're in a totally different culture today. You can get around the world in 24 hours even anywhere. And people can play a significant role in moving these pathogens around. The other one is methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, or simply known as MRSA. How many people have heard of MRSA before? It's a pleasure to do it. It's something to watch out for. A lot of people get it when they go to the gyms and clubs, or if they have a cut on their skin or something, they can pick it up. It's drug resistant. Hospitals, ironically, are one of the most dangerous places to pick up cancer. And it's something that we'll be hearing about a lot more in the future. And again, there's just a tremendous need for developing new drugs and research for cancer. So those are some existing plagues that we're seeing that could explode. What about what the future holds for us? Well, we don't really know. It's really hard to predict what will happen. We have had some things happen recently that should give us pause to take notes. For example, West Nile virus was first introduced to this hemisphere in the Neo-Metropolitan area in 1999. There are lots of lessons that we should have learned from that introduction. It's most likely that future threats will be viruses like the influenza virus. We'll certainly continue to see, potentially see some flu pandemics. Viruses, because they can change so quickly and reassort, they become modified, become more dangerous, we'll probably see this. You might see development of new modes of transmission, which can make pathogens which are moderate, much more severe. Because everything moves so much faster in today's world, we'll probably have introductions of pathogens that we never noticed or saw before. So these are the general characteristics of what we should look out for. And this is no surprise. Through time, as times have changed, we've seen the origin of new plagues. And certainly, plagues have evolved along with the evolution of human societies. If we just look at a timeline, from about 50,000 years ago to today, we can see distinct points in time which have given significant rise to new pandemics. For example, with the advent of agriculture, people started to come together. They started to build towns and then cities. They started storing food, which brought rats in. They started living in closer proximity. They started trading with other civilizations and moving farther. People's behavior started to change. Even things like sexual behavior change and can lead to the rise of the pathogens and transmission. So today we're faced with a lot of problems, a lot of challenges over time as we think about the plagues of the future. So this has been a bit gloomy. I hope that you're not too depressed. There's actually no reason to be depressed. We're actually living in a time where we can be optimistic. We have a lot of tools. Technology has really changed for us. And there is a lot of hope. So there's no need to be depressed about these pandemics. For example, in the last 3 years, the National Institutes of Health has built several laboratories around the country, which are highly contained facilities where scientists can really work efficiently with these pathogens to try to understand what makes them so effective, and to develop new, more effective vaccines, better drugs, and new ways to detect viruses and other pathogens. And I want to finish up by just leading you to, or mentioning some of the different groups that are working on disease ecology, disease ethology across campus. This is a highly collaborative university. Even though we have all these different little colleges and units, people really collaborate across these. And these are just some of the groups that you might want to check out, where there are opportunities for undergraduate students to do research, to get involved, to travel abroad and get involved in different programs. So I want to thank you for your attention, and I can't let you leave without giving you a little bit of advice. And I know you've been getting a lot of advice this weekend from your family, from your friends, from your orientation counselors, but I have three pieces of advice. The first is, as you start out your career at Cornell, take advantage of all the resources that are here. There's so much here that's offered to you to support you and help you to succeed. And they're really underutilized. I'm always amazed at how rarely my advice is go to grad school or take advantage of all the opportunities that are here. So try to use those resources that are here for you. Second is to persevere, stand your talk, and be challenging, and just don't give up. Just keep working and persevere. And the third piece of advice is to be a gift. Okay. Who knows? Maybe one of you out in the audience someday is going to develop a drug that could be used to treat, save the lives of thousands of people in the country. Someone out in the audience will engineer a new way of detecting one of these deadly pathogens. So dream big, don't be afraid to dream big. And make us proud, and you will. But most of all, make yourselves proud. Thank you. So we've got a little bit of time. If there are any questions? Now, with some other viruses that are fairly close to the end, like these influenza viruses, you tend to get a lot of it sooner, so that's not deadly in the end of the virus. So, good question. Any other questions? Okay. Off-world viral testing. So, for example, viruses on Mars? Is that what you mean? Or outer space? Yeah. You know, that's a great question, and I imagine that the scientists that are going out to space are testing. I know they are for bacteria, I'm sure they are for viruses, but I don't know if they found anything. Thank you for asking that, because I'm going to look that up and see what's out there. It's really interesting. If there's life, then they're probably all pathogens. The question was the ethics of recreating pathogens from the past. Is it legal? So ethics aside, is it legal to do that? And it is legal, not for your average citizen, or even for me. I would have to get a special permit probably to do that. And I'd probably get, you know, a very big fingerprint in it, and I'd gone through all that, whatever else, the background checks. So, but it is legal for our government, and so this is something we talked about in my class. When is it okay for the government to step in and do something like this? And this was a government-funded program that recreated the virus, and so they were fully within their legal rights. Yeah, another question. And this is the last question, and then I'll let you go, but if you have more questions, come on down after. Okay, last question. So that's a great question. How well guarded are these pathogens? This is how we know, for example, it took a long time to figure it out, but this is how we know that anthrax came from our facilities in the U.S. Because they do have very rigorous surveillance. In fact, at Fort Beecher, where the anthrax virus came from, everyone's videotaped. So, which is kind of, you know, feels like a violation of your personal rights. If you're, my colleagues who work there don't really like it, but there's video surveillance. Also, there are logbooks. People have to check in, check out. I worked at one of these facilities this past summer in Colorado, and they're very, very careful about material. It's really, it's impossible to take anything in and out of these facilities. So that doesn't mean that, you know, you have a malfunction of some sort, electrical power goes out, or they have backup generators, but something could happen. So it's not absolutely impossible, but it's very difficult. So. All right, so that's the last question. Thank you for your attention.